Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Cuba is in a period of official mourning following the death of Fidel Castro, a man who some, including many Cubans, see as a liberator of historical proportions. Others, including many in the large expat community, are celebrating Castro's death as the end of a ruthless autocrat who jailed tens of thousands of dissidents, killing and torturing many of them, and repressed Cuba by banning free speech, freedom of assembly, and a free press. WBUR's Simone Rios spoke to prominent Cubans in the Boston area and found that many are neither celebrating nor mourning the death of Fidel Castro.
My name is Arturo Sandoval, and I was born in Artemisa, which is a little village of the countryside of Cuba.
Arturo Sandoval is a protege of the great trumpeter Dizzy Gillespie and one of the most prominent defectors from Fidel Castro's Cuba. He was in town this weekend at Scholars Jazz Club, and he was in the middle of a set when Raul Castro announced his brother Fidel had died.
I didn't find out until almost midnight when I get to the room and I turn on my phone. I got so many messages from friends and relatives. It's a mixed feeling because I think nobody should get happy or celebrate the death of any human. But in this case, it means a lot more than a person who died. It's a philosophy.
Like many Cuban exiles living in the United States, Sandoval's story is deeply personal. In 1990, he escaped Cuba while touring Europe. His next order of business was to send for his parents.
They got their passport in order, everything was ready. I sent the plane tickets, everything was good to go. And the day before, they called them to immigration office there. And they took the passports and the plane tickets and they turned down and dropped it in the garbage can right in front of them. And they told them, forget about it. I got order from Fidel Castro in person to tell you that you're never going to be able to leave the country. Forget about to see your son.
Both in their 70s, Sandoval's parents jumped onto a raft with 10 other people bound for Florida. He says they were among the oldest people he knows of ever to make the trip by raft. Sandoval's story is not unusual among Cuban Americans, but among some Boston area Cubans, the stories of suffering under Fidel Castro are more distant. Isaac Bornstein left Cuba as a boy in 1960. The year after Castro swept into Havana with his rebel army. 56 years later, and the supreme commander is dead.
I feel sad. I feel like for those of us who are old enough to both have understood the importance of history and live through history, see one of the real important figures of history lose his life. Somebody who, for me, the biggest sadness is, who's going to speak for the poor in the developing world?
Borenstein spent 16 years on the bench as a superior court judge in Massachusetts and now teaches at Suffolk Law School. He leads a trip of students to a law school in Cuba where they study things like inheritance law in a socialist legal system. He says he'd like to see Cuba preserve the benefits of the Castro Revolution, such as the elimination of illiteracy and health care for all Cubans, while opening the doors to democracy and a mixed economy.
Let's make sure we guarantee people the basic way of life economically. And let's also have more openness, access to the internet, newspaper, publications, maybe more democratic electoral processes.
The death of Fidel Castro resonates far beyond the borders of Cuba.
If we were meeting not in Boston, Massachusetts, but in Johannesburg, South Africa, many would remember him as the only political leader willing to deploy troops to stop a South African apartheid regime invasion of Angola.
Jorge Dominguez teaches Latin American studies at Harvard. He also left Cuba as a child.
If we were speaking not in Massachusetts but in Haiti, there are a great many people in Haiti of all sorts, but certainly many poor people, who have been attended to by Cuban healthcare personnel.
Dominguez says Castro's good works deserve praise, but he's not blind to the charges against the former Cuban leader, that he was a dictator who jailed thousands of political prisoners. What Dominguez is certain about is the world has lost a highly complex figure, the likes of which history does not often see.
Ultimately, probably what I miss the most about him is all of the intrinsic complexity. Most political figures are not that complex, are just not that interesting. And he was.
Fidel Castro prophesied early in his career that history would absolve him. Cuban immigrant Miren Uriarte agrees.
I think it will. Given the importance in today's world of inequality between the poor and the rich, Cuba hit that straight on. And I think that's what he will be remembered for.
Uriarte is a Boston School Committee member and professor emeritus of sociology at UMass Boston. She came to the U.S. from Cuba as a young girl and has spent decades trying to help normalize relations between the U.S. and Cuba. Uriarte says she understands why people hurt by the revolution despise Castro, but she can also see why others revere him.
This is not about black and white. Revolutions are not about black and white. There's all kinds of tones of gray.
Asked whether she considers herself pro-Fidel, Uriarte laughs and says she's pro-Cuba.
That was WBUR's Simone Rios reporting on reaction to the death of Cuban leader Fidel Castro. This is Moonglow, played by the Benny Goodman Quartet. Moonglow is also the title of Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Michael Chabon's new novel. Moonglow is framed as a memoir in which the narrator, a guy named Michael Chabon, recounts the life of his grandparents who came of age in the period of this music. Much of the narrative is a kind of deathbed confession from the grandfather, who tells Chabon stories about World War II combat, Jewish life in post-war America, mental illness, the Holocaust, and the early development of rockets. Now, in his note to readers, Chabon says this: "In preparing this memoir, I have stuck to facts, except when facts refuse to conform with memory, narrative, purpose, or the truth as I prefer to understand it." Michael Chabon is the author of several books, including The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, for which he won the Pulitzer Prize in Fiction. He'll be at the Brookline Booksmith event at the Coolidge Corner Theater tonight, and he joins us now. And Michael Chabon, great to have you. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Anthony. It's very good to be here.
Yeah, it's great, and I'm just loving this book. I'm about 100 pages into it, which is no small feat because I'm way too busy to read big, thick books, but this is so good that
it's
grabbed
you.
Me.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
And listeners, we want to invite you into this conversation. Have you read Michael Chabon's other novels? Have you read this latest one, Moonglow? What do you think about a book of fiction disguised as a memoir? What questions do you have for Michael Chabon? You can give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So I want to ask you about that wonderful sort of disclaimer at the beginning, saying that, you know, you're adhering to facts for as long as facts are basically convenient to be adhered to.
Right. I'm saying I'm not adhering to them at all, is what I'm really saying. Yeah.
But it sounds like a statement really in defense of fiction, the novel, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think... I've come of age as a novelist in the era of the creative nonfiction renaissance and the ascendancy of the literary memoir. And I've had to, in a sense, stand by and watch as these documents, many of them, I hasten to say, are some of my favorite books and some of the most beautiful books of the past quarter century or so. This Boy's Life by Tobias Wolff, or I think When the Granddaddy of the Genre is Stop Time by Frank Conroy is such a beautiful book. I'm not really knocking memoirists per se, but this idea that what you get between the covers of a memoir is the truth, is factual, is highly dubious statement. So I think I wanted to try to somehow find a way in telling this story, among all the other things I was trying to do, to sort of assert the power of fiction to tell a truth that you could never get at through any other means, that the only way to arrive at it is by making up a lie, is telling a lie.
Right.
So,
and now this idea of making up a lie or telling a series of lies, I mean, it's sort of, you're sort of entering into a kind of contract with the reader, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, we sort
really
of know
important.
That. That's
really important.
Yeah.
It's very important. And yeah. So to me, what makes the lies of the novelist not just permissible, but potentially, you know, beautiful or admirable, is the fact that the reader knows perfectly well from the beginning that this is a lie. The reader gives her consent to be lied to and says, please lie to me. I've come to you to be lied to. Just make it a good one, please.
Yeah.
And that's really important. I mean, that's how it works with, you know, stage magic, right? That's a comparison I've drawn frequently where, you know, you know, the magician says, like, you know, I'm not actually going to be sawing.
Right. This is sleight
of
hand. This is right.
You know, yeah. Right. And you can sit there and try to figure out how I'm doing it if you want to, or you could just sit back and enjoy the illusion or whatever. But it's there is that contract. There's that implicit contract. And to me, that is missing sometimes with memoirs, where the reader, I feel often, and I speak as a reader of memoirs, is often really not certain where how to evaluate this, or to put all of one's faith in the teller and say, look, okay, obviously you're just going to be telling me everything that ever really happened in this case, or how much invention is taking place. It's much less clear. That makes me nervous. That makes me uncomfortable.
But aren't they both? I mean, whether it's memoir or in your case, faux memoir, whether you're dealing with sort of a statement that this is a series of lies and I'm not going to pretend otherwise, mm-hmm. to this is the best sort of recollection I have as mm-hmm. to what happened. Aren't they both sort of serving a bigger truth?
I don't know exactly. I don't know the answer to that. And there are memoirs and there are memoirs.
Yeah.
And some memoirs, I think some of the ones that might be considered the greatest, find ways to signal either openly or in implicit ways when characters, personages are being conflated, or maybe they've left someone out. They might be an afterword or acknowledgement or something that lets you know. Obviously, no one has the kind of perfect recall for conversations that took place decades ago that you often encounter.
Right.
How much readers actually, the average reader, if there is such a thing, who picks up a memoir and is reading a report in this memoir of what someone said to someone, you know, 40 years ago, how much the average reader is going to be thinking, oh, I'm sure the writer's making this all up because nobody could remember that, and how much the reader is thinking, you know, writers are magical people. Maybe if you're a writer, you actually can remember things that happened 40 years ago.
Right.
I don't
actually
know.
They have special brains that retain these amazing facts.
I mean, I think that's what I thought when I was a kid.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Listeners, if you're just joining us, Michael Chabon is the author of Moonglow, a novel. It's sort of a faux memoir. It's sort of framed as a memoir, but it's a novel. And I want you to tell me, Michael, a little bit about the character of your grandfather. Now, I say your grandfather because the narrator is a guy named Michael Chabon, mm-hmm. so there's going to be a lot of... Anyway, this is, tell me
yes,
about the grandfather.
The grandfather.
That's what I meant to ask.
The grandfather in this novel is a... in a way, he's a kind of paradigm of the tough Jew, of the silent, taciturn, emotionally not particularly connected male of his generation. You know, I had relatives like that growing up. Not my grandfather. I mean, my grandfather came out of a very different kind of approach to being a man. Not that he was very touchy-feely. He wasn't the most... he wasn't especially connected to his emotions, I would say, either, but he was very verbal and he loved to talk. He loved wordplay and joking around. And this is this sort of strong, silent type. This man is, you know, I'll be honest with you. He, in sort of putting together this character out of materials from people I remember from my childhood, from relatives, from various kinds of men I've known over the course of my life, especially from this generation born in the grandfather here is born in 1917. In many ways, it's more than anything else, this is kind of a self-portrait. In a way, this is sort of a what if, and the what if of this novel is, what if I didn't, for whatever reason, struggle as hard as I struggle not to be taciturn, misanthropic, antisocial, sort of have a kind of disdainful attitude toward all humanity, including oneself. I have all those tendencies in me. And for various reasons, it's become important to me over the course of my life to sort of fight against those tendencies. Hmm. And not only that, this grandfather is a very violent man. He gets very angry.
Yeah.
And sometimes he gets uncontrollably angry.
Yeah, there's a scene very early on in the movie where he essentially, I mean, this lands him in jail, right? He mm-hmm. almost strangles someone.
Prison.
In prison, yeah. Mm-hmm. Because he gets so mad at losing his job that he strangles someone with a piano?
It's a telephone cord.
A telephone cord, that's
yeah.
it, yeah.
Yes, his boss.
So big
yeah.
man, big appetites, big reactions, big emotions. Mm-hmm.
But very tightly wrapped so yeah. that when they do come out, they come out in a very kind of an uncontrollable way. Uncontrollable burn, you know, like an oil well that's been set on fire. And once it's set on fire, it's hard to put it out.
And he's a great storyteller. One of the first stories you learn about him early on is he explains to his grandson, Michael Chabon, that his first sexual experience was with a bearded woman. It's a good detail.
Yeah. yeah. As far as I know, that is not the case with my actual grandfather, though we didn't really ever talk about it. So yeah. It could have been. But yeah, he... I mean, the thing is, actually, he never has been much of a storyteller. And I think at one point the narrator says something like, 90% of everything I ever learned about my grandfather, I learned in the last 10 days of his life.
Yeah.
And it's only once the grandfather is dying, and he's basically in the palliative care phase of terminal cancer, and he's on heavy painkillers, he's on Dilaudid, that this sort of loosens his tongue and jars his memory, and he finally begins to talk. And that actually does have some basis in my real life experience, in that my grandfather, although he was talkative and he did tell stories and he wasn't closed up the way this man is, still, when he was dying at my mother's house and he was in the same terminal phase of cancer and on heavy painkillers, he talked a lot, and he told me stories, but the things that he was telling me were things I had never heard before.
Oh, interesting.
And that is what...
Did you realize then that, hey, this is material for a book?
I mean, no, I did not, but what I did, I think, start to understand then, and it's a painful understanding, and it's one that has, you know, continued, and in some ways the pain of it has only intensified over the years, is that I was with this man I was 25 when he died. So for 25 years of my life, I had the chance to talk to this guy, you know, and realize that he was a human being, and not that some with your grandparents, if we have a tendency to sometimes idealize our parents, it's even more with our grandparents. And when I say idealize, I don't necessarily mean we look highly on them. We can also sort of negatively idealize our grandparents too. They become demonized or they become glorified. You think like grandpa's, you know, the guy that wears.
But we don't make that effort to really excavate and deep into their soul
figure
out
can't.
Who they are.
We're not ready to. And, right. And I think one of the tragedies of life is that when you hit the age where you actually turn backward and you say, you know, who are those people or who were those people?
Yeah.
It's too late usually. They're either gone already or they go quickly thereafter.
Well, the grandfather in Moonglow says to his grandson, Michael Chabon, after I'm gone, write it down. Explain everything. Make it mean something. Use a lot of those fancy metaphors of yours. Put the whole thing in proper chronological order, not like this mishmash I'm making it you. So, you know, what's interesting about that is your narrator doesn't put it in chronological mm-hmm. order, but he does paint a pretty vivid picture of this guy and of this amazing time in America. Mm-hmm. So does he carry out his grandfather's wish?
Well, in a way, but the thing about this guy, this grandfather, and it's in a way this is when it becomes most clear, yeah. is he's taunting his grandson with that. He's saying, I know you. You have these romantic notions. You have these, you know, it actually comes in the context of his saying, I'm ashamed of myself. I'm ashamed of my life. And when I look back on what I've done, I wish I hadn't. And so he's really baiting his grandson in a way, saying you're going to make something out of this that is so much more impressive than how I feel about my life. He's kind of a nihilistic dude, the grandfather, and so in a way, if in writing this novel and telling this story, my narrator is, in a sense, he's actually going against his grandfather's wishes in a certain way. If he were to really follow his grandfather's wishes, he would have left everything completely forgotten and unremarked upon, because I think that's how the grandfather would have preferred it all to be.
Interesting. Now, I want to ask you about the grandmother. Tell me about her, but tell me about this character. What makes her tick, who she is? What's the sort of short profile?
Well, what makes her tick is sort of the ultimate mystery of the whole book.
Right.
And she is a very enigmatic figure in the life of her husband, in the life of her daughter, and in the life of her grandson as well. She was born in France. She emigrated to the United States after the war. Her story is clearly caught up with the Holocaust, with the German occupation of France, with the deportation of French Jews. But how her story is caught up with that, and in what manner she came through that experience, and what she did or did not do to survive, is a source of profound mystery throughout the entire length of the book. And even in one's daily experience of this woman, and we get some scenes from the point of view of the grandson when he's a little boy and he's just trying to sort of sort out the adult world the way a 4 or 5 year old might start to try to do. And this woman, his grandmother, causes him problems from the beginning, because sometimes she's vibrant and big and funny and energetic, and she carries out these sort of imaginary games with him, and she takes him places, and she loves him intensely. And then the next time he sees her, she's all she wants to do is lie in bed, and she can't come out of her room, and she has nothing for him, and she's clearly depressed. And he's to try to get a sense of someone who's never quite the same person twice is the challenge for the narrator.
Right. And so toward the end of the novel, the narrator makes a really shocking discovery about his grandmother, and it leads the reader and the narrator to question the truth of the whole sort of story, which already we know is a fiction, but it's an interesting moment. I wonder if you could read a section of that part. It's right in the middle there on page 356.
Sure, yes. The narrator has, long after his grandfather's death, even longer after his grandmother's death, he's thinking maybe of writing a novel somehow based on his grandmother's life, and so he actually starts digging around and doing some research, and he tracks down some key information about her that is, as you say, it comes as a real shock. one by one, I began to subject my memories of my grandmother, of the things she had told me and the way she had behaved, to a formal review, a kind of failure analysis, searching and testing them for their content of deceit, for the hidden presence in them of the truth. I kept what I had learned from my wife until I returned from Mantaloking. I kept it from my mother and the rest of the world until I began to research and write this memoir, repudiating a novelistic approach to the material. Sometimes even lovers of fiction can be satisfied only by the truth. I felt like I needed to get my story straight, so to speak, in my mind and in my heart. I needed to work out, if I could, the relationship between the things I had heard and learned about my family and its history while growing up and the things I now knew to be true.
And we're not going to give away what the great reveal is, but I love that paragraph because there's so much in there that you play with in this book. I mean, among them, this idea that readers of fiction still hunger to know what is fact and
I mean,
truth.
It's a strange thing, and it's true of me as a reader. You're reading a novel, and there's a female character in the novel, a main character, and she's described as having, a head of blonde curls, and then you look at the author photo and you see the author has a head of blonde curls, and you can't help thinking, like, is this based on her life? How much of this is true? There's always that level. There's a game that's implicitly played between author and reader always, I think, and it's not even a conscious game, I think, a lot of the time, over just how much of this is true. It's something I actually dealt with in my book Wonder Boys too, and so part of what I was trying to do here was just make that that game explicit, but also, you know, to try to get at this idea of this is what happens in families, all families, is that something, the story emerges, the stories emerge, but whether those stories are the truth or not is far from clear.
Well, you hear the Benny Goodman coming back, which means we just have seconds left, but I have to ask you this. Will you ever write a memoir based solely on the facts of your life?
Well, if I do, I probably won't tell anyone that's what it is.
Okay. Michael Chabon is the author of several books, including The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, for which he won the Pulitzer Prize. His new novel is Moonglow. He'll be at a Brookline Booksmith event at the Coolidge Corner Theater tonight, and you can find a lot more information at radioboston.org. Michael Chabon, such a pleasure. Thank you for the book, and thank you for coming
in. Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And that's it for today. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.